Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, and back with us now is City Council Speaker Corey Johnson for one of his occasional appearances on the show to talk about New York City issues and take your calls. His own district is Chelsea, Hell's Kitchen, Greenwich Village, West Soho, Hudson Square, Times Square, the Garment District, Flatiron, and parts of the Upper West Side. One big piece of Corey Johnson news this week, he and the mayor just concluded a new budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st, and it includes reduced fare metro cards for low-income New Yorkers, as the speaker has wanted. The mayor was about the idea, but they're doing it. Hi, Speaker Johnson. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. I'm so happy to be here.
And listeners, as usual, you're invited to call in with questions for the speaker, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Let's start with a couple of budget items. We're not going to make people's eyes glaze over by talking about the whole, what is it, $96
billion
budget?
$89
billion
budget.
But what about fair fares? Who's eligible for what?
Well, fair fares is this amazing concept that was dreamed up by the Community Service Society with the advocacy of the Riders Alliance a few years ago. And it's a program that is going to allow for people living below the federal poverty line, an individual making less than $12,000 a year, or a family of four making less than $25,100 a year, people that are begging for swipes to get onto the subway that many New Yorkers see, they would get half price metro cards, which would save these families or individuals about over $700 a year, which is a big deal if you're making that little money. And so this was one of the main cornerstones and pillars of our budget response, the city council's. We fought, we advocated, we agitated, we pushed and cajoled, and ultimately we came to a great agreement with Mayor de Blasio, and I am thrilled and excited that this is included in the budget.
What's the poverty line for an individual, single individual? Do you
less know? Than $12,000 a year.
So that's who could get it as an individual.
And a family of four is less than $25,100 a year. The number of New Yorkers who fall currently below the federal poverty line is about 800,000 people. We don't expect that every person is going to sign up. We think probably about half of those folks will. The total cost of the program over time, if everyone did sign up, would be about $212 million.
Per year.
Per year. We've budgeted $106 million this year for it with an implementation date of January 1st, halfway through the fiscal year. New York City's fiscal year starts July 1st. And so we're going to spend the next 6 months advertising, educating, letting folks know about the program, working with community-based organizations, and we want it to be a big success.
So it'll actually take effect for your swipe starting New Year's.
That's right.
And where's the money going to come from? Because if you're talking 100 million for this year, and then as it expands, 200 million plus per year after that. I mean, I realize that's not that much money in the course of a $90 billion budget, but still, $100 million here, $100 million there, you're talking real money, as somebody once said.
Absolutely. And one thing that we need to do in our budget is learn how to save more money, learn how to figure out where there are efficiencies, where we don't need to be spending money that we're currently spending. When Mayor de Blasio took office, his first budget was about $73, $74 billion. This year, up to $89 billion. That's a $15 billion increase in 4 years. One of the things that the council advocated for, which was included in the budget, was a set aside of reserves. So when there is a downturn, we have money to help us cushion a fall a little bit so we won't have to cut key social service programs. So in this budget, there's $225 million set aside in reserves for the future. And one thing that the mayor and I spoke about during the negotiations was coming up with a real citywide savings plan, agency by agency, to save save money in the future.
Another thing that you told me before we went on the air that you're excited about in this budget is funding for disabled students who go to public schools.
I am. I don't want to get emotional. I got emotional when I spoke about this in the rotunda the other night. I'm so moved by the fact that there were five folks that came and spoke on the final day of the budget hearings, the executive budget hearings, where the public can come and testify on whatever they want. I, as speaker, sat through those hearings from the very beginning till the end. I think we ended at 8:30 at night. And there were five folks that came and talked about accessibility for disabled children in New York City. There are many, many schools in New York City where if you have a disabled child and they are in a wheelchair or need other special accessibility requirements, they literally cannot get into the school and get an education. So we advocated, because of what these parents said, for $150 million to make public schools more accessible for these children. And in this budget, we got $150 million to make schools more accessible. I am very, very proud of including this, and I think it's the right thing to do.
And one other thing on the budget before we go to some calls, the total New York City budget, as you said, it'll be $89 billion for this next fiscal year. That's $4 billion more than last year and almost 20% more, 19%. Than when Mayor de Blasio first came to office. And there are some budget watchdogs who say, geez, you know, this is a lot of commitments that the city is making in the de Blasio era, and you all can get away with it at the moment because it's been a good time for tax revenues in New York City. There may be a lot of poor New Yorkers out there, but business is doing well, and so there's a lot of tax revenue flowing into the city coffers. It's not always going to be like that. Are you overextending the city's commitment with this kind of budget growth in the de Blasio years?
It's a great question, and I just want to quickly give some top-line numbers. As you said, the budget's grown 19% in 4 years, $89 billion budget. Last year, tourism at an all-time high. We saw a big bump in one-time money that came in through personal income tax prepayments because of the federal tax law that went into effect, and so we saw a jump there. We've seen an expansion of 700,000 new jobs created in New York City over the last 7 years. And so when you look at the top line numbers, unemployment at an all-time low, budget growing, we're in a good situation. But at the same exact time, 20% of New Yorkers are living either at or below the federal poverty line. 800,000 people, as we said, qualify for this program, Fair Fares. And, you know, we have to ensure we have a social safety net. One thing that I think is really important to say in all of this is that we need to sock money aside. And that's why the council asked for $500 million in reserves. We got $225 million, which brings the total reserve amount up to about $10 billion, the highest amount the city's ever had. No one ever sets a schedule and says, this is when the recession's coming. You never know that. That's why you need to have money set aside.
And what about the Trump tax law? There's been so much speculation, and I guess it's still speculation, about how it's going to affect individuals in New York, families in New York, and revenues for city government and state government. What are you projecting?
Well, it's hard at this point. We don't think the full effect will be seen until 2021 or 2022 for a variety of reasons. One thing that is going to be a major problem at some point is the state and local tax deduction, the SALT issue, where over a third of New Yorkers actually took a SALT deduction. And then you look at the entire metropolitan area, Westchester, Long Island, Northern New Jersey, Connecticut. We are a major area where that tax deduction was very helpful to many individuals and families. So we're afraid of what that effect could have on the city's budget. But we saw a big bump in personal income tax money come in because people prepaid their taxes before the start of the year. We don't expect all of that money to come in next year. We keep seeing property tax revenue climb and climb and climb. And one thing that the council asked for was a property tax rebate of $400 in this budget. We didn't get it. But we have a commitment to create a property tax commission with Mayor de Blasio, put forward recommendations, go to the state legislature next year, and try to finally fix our broken property tax system.
Judy in Richmond Hill, you're on WNYC with New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Is there, for someone who is disabled, or I have to go to a lot of doctors, and is there a place for me in the subway fare card thing?
Well, I believe that, first of all, good morning. Thanks for calling in. Thank you. I believe that there are, I think, and I could be wrong, there's already a program for folks in the MTA, whether you're a senior citizen or you're someone who is disabled, you get a discounted fare. But I will check on that, and I'm happy to take your information offline and have my staff get back to you. But one thing that I think is really important, Judy, is that so many of our subway stations in New York City are inaccessible. If you are someone who's in a wheelchair, you actually can't use all of our stations.
I walk with a cane, and the stairs are unbelievable for me sometimes.
Yeah, so we need to make our subway stations accessible. Part of the Andy Byford plan, the new head of New York City Transit, has been creating more accessible stations from an elevator perspective, and for the stations that currently have elevators, we have to make sure they're actually working. So much of the time they're out of order. And so one of the things we have to do almost more than 30 years after the Americans with Disabilities Act became a law, we have to make sure we have real accessibility in New York City's in the subways, in the schools, and everywhere else. So, Judy, we're happy to take your information, and I'm happy to have my staff get back to you on that.
Judy will do that. So it's not, in case there is a discount that she's already eligible for, this is not a half fare discount on top of other discounts, so like the senior reduced fare MetroCard, if that person is also below the poverty line.
No
additional discount.
No, that's right.
Mark in Astoria, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Good morning, Mr. Speaker. Congratulations on the low fare cards.
Thank you.
I'm a parent of two high school kids, one a graduate of a specialized school and one a graduate of a CTEC program in Queens. And one of the things I haven't heard in the debate about specialized schools is the fact that the number of seats has been fairly static for a long time. And I'm wondering if part of the debate the council could start talking about, or how they would talk about, both expanding the number of specialized schools, expanding the number of seats and facilities in the existing schools so more kids can go, and then also looking at schools like Towns and Harris, Nest, Eleanor Roosevelt, which are also outstanding. We just need to create more seats in more outstanding schools and not only fight about how to get into them.
I agree with you. I think that this is a very big issue, of course, that people are passionate about on all sides when it comes to children's education in New York City. One of the things, I believe Tom Allen, the publisher of City and State, along with my colleague in the council, Rafael Espinal, had an op-ed last week in City and State about this very issue that you just mentioned, which is creating more specialized high schools so that there is more opportunity throughout the city, so we're not static on the number of schools that have existed for a long time. I think that's one way to look at this. Another way to look at this is the numbers that we currently have are not reflective of the city. And the way to actually tackle that, we have to have an open conversation about that engages all stakeholders. The number of Black and Latino students that are getting into these specialized high schools is unacceptable. And we know that when you apply to Harvard or Yale, you don't take one test to get in. At the exact same time, we want to ensure that this is a conversation that everyone feels engaged in, because it's an emotional debate. The state legislature, which has a major role in this, has said that they are not tackling it in the next month, that they're going to come back and look at it next year. So we're going to have time to have a full conversation about more specialized schools, about the test, about how to make sure it's more representative of New York City students writ large. And I think that's a conversation that everyone needs to be engaged in. But I am really grateful for your call this morning in highlighting this fact, which I don't think has been talked about enough.
Mark, thank you for your call. I want to ask you about a hearing that City Council's Committee on Public Safety held yesterday, and we did a segment on this show on Tuesday in advance of it, with respect to the NYPD's gang database, which is that relatively secret, I understand, list of names that the city considers to be people who the city considers to be gang involved, based on apparently very broad criteria, like who they associate with or what color clothing they wear. We talked about it on Tuesday's show with Anthony Posada of the Legal Aid Society and activist Talon Murphy, who criticized the system because a lot of people who don't even know it get tagged by the NYPD as gang involved, and then that comes back to haunt them in later contacts with the NYPD in some of those cases. So what did you learn at that hearing, and does the policy and the practice need to change at all?
Well, I wasn't at that hearing myself, but I, of course, know about this issue. The chair of our Public Safety Committee, Donovan Richards, chaired that hearing, and the chief of detectives, Dermot Shea, testified with other NYPD personnel on this issue. Look, there is very real civil liberties concerns here related to if you have not done anything wrong and you end up in this database, what does that do to your future? It is not transparent. One thing that the NYPD said is that when they had similar lists in the past going after organized crime figures, they had a database that looked at folks that were involved in organized crime. And during that time, those were not people of color. In this instance, many of the folks, the vast majority, are young men of color who are in this gang database. So we have to balance both figuring out who is gang involved and how we actually ensure that they are not harming individuals in New York City. And at the exact same time, not letting someone who hasn't done anything wrong end up in this database. That is the balance between civil liberties and public safety. There should be a way to address it in a meaningful way. And I look forward to having that conversation. I think I just want to say this, Brian. We do not want young people who haven't done anything wrong to end up in this database and have their lives ruined. And we saw the numbers. The numbers used to be 34,000 people. The NYPD has worked on that number. Now it's down to 14,000 people. There still could be people in that database that shouldn't be in there. So we have to keep checking. They said they check every 2 or 3 years. We have to check more often on those names.
Cassius in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC with Speaker Corey Johnson. Hi, Cassius.
Hey, good morning, Brian. And hello, Corey.
Good morning.
Good morning. I called in the last time you were on the show, and I asked if you'd be willing to admit maybe the city needs to admit that mistakes have been made in regards to letting the app cars grow with no cap on them, no limit. And I saw a photograph of me yesterday, the day before, on Twitter with you meeting with the head of Uber. You know, they always manage to materialize whenever any city starts talking about putting a cap on them.
So let me jump in here just for time. You did meet with the Uber CEO this week, I see, and to Cassius, who I know from his previous calls is a yellow cab driver, and the many others in that that yellow boat who feel this way. They were probably glad to see that last month you apologized, do I have this right, for failing to impose limits on Uber in 2015 when you didn't support a cap on new permits that the mayor proposed. So
I did apologize, yes, and I still feel that way.
And so what'd you tell the CEO of Uber this week?
Well, I just want to be clear, when you're looking at legislation, especially legislation and a legislative package that's as complicated as looking at the yellow industry, the green industry, the for-hire vehicle industry, Uber, Lyft, liveries, congestion issues, driver benefit issues, a cap on licenses. This is all very complicated stuff. And so you have to talk to every stakeholder. So we have talked literally to every sector that would be affected by this, whether it be liveries, greens, yellows, Uber, et cetera, the TLC. And so we're going to have those conversations. We had a hearing on a package of bills that a series of council members have put forward, and we want to talk to all stakeholders. I'm not going to say exactly what was discussed in the meeting because I want to respect the privacy of the meeting, but I'll tell you that Uber heard some very serious concerns from me about where I believe we need to take action on this and where there's a level of disagreement. We're going to keep talking to all stakeholders. This is going to be an issue that's done on the merits with finally this, Brian, three guiding principles. Number one, how do you protect drivers, all drivers, yellow, green, Uber, etc.? Number two, how do you do something on congestion? And number three, how do you create fairness and some level of parity between the for-hire vehicle app regulate cars and yellows?
Let me get two quick responses on two last things. One is, and I know this is a complicated issue, but there was the consent decree this week between the city and the federal government regarding the horrible conditions in so many NYCHA buildings and apartments, which it looks like the city is going to have to spend $2 billion under order of the federal government or an agreement with the federal government. How does that affect the new budget?
Well, that money is going to come out of the capital budget. So in our city, we have an expense budget, which is the $89 billion budget that we just spoke about earlier. And on the other side is a four-year capital budget that rolls in some ways year to year, funding capital things like transportation, public housing, schools, parks, etc. The money that was talked about as part of the consent decree was money that will come out of the capital budget. It's going to have, of course, a big effect, but we can manage it. And ultimately, this is about the life and safety health issues related to NYCHA residents, public housing residents. So I'm glad they're going to get the money. Heat, hot water, mold, lead paint, etc. NYCHA residents deserve habitable homes that give them respect and dignity.
And finally, and briefly, I hear you're losing somebody who's not a public figure, but is very powerful in city council circles. Ramon Martinez, the city council's chief of staff, who Politico New York says has for years cultivated a reputation as being the legislative body's chief enforcer. Why is Ramon Martinez leaving, and what does it mean for getting your agenda through?
You know, Ramon's going to, I doubt he's listening, but he's going to kill me because he doesn't want me to talk about this. Today he said, because he's such a great person, should be focused on the budget that we're passing and the members who work so hard on it. But I have to say, in the last 5 months, he has been invaluable to me. I actually really love him. He's an amazing person. I worked with him before I was speaker when I was on the council. He is a great person. He is a legend in city government. He has respect, I think, from all 51 council members. It's a serious loss. I'm actually very sad about it, but I'm also very happy for him. He has a big family, and he deserves to go and do great things. So we love you, Ramon. You're the best, and I'm going to keep calling him for advice in the future.
And New York City Council Speaker Corey Johnson, keep coming on here. We'll keep taking phone calls from New Yorkers and talking about what's going on.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And ahead of this year's midterm elections, WNYC and Gothamist are surveying listeners to find out what kinds of civic engagement our listeners and readers already participate in, and what some of the hurdles are to doing more, and how we can get help get people more involved. If you want to take the survey, it's available now. Go to wnyc.org/civic survey, wnyc.org/civic survey. And we want to hear from you on this on the phones now to help kind of set up the lines of conversation around this topic. So give us a call at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, to answer the question, why, if you want to do more, don't you do more in terms of civic engagement? What are the hurdles? And we'll share with our guest, who we'll introduce in a minute, some ideas for how you can be more civically engaged. But our question right now is, if you don't do as much as you sometimes think you would like to do in terms of political or other civic engagement, what have been the hurdles for you? Why haven't you started, or why haven't you gone further? Have you ever thought about this with respect to yourself? If so, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And obviously this year the news is full of stories of record numbers of people running for office, whether it's at the local level like school board or town council, or all the way up to Congress and governor, and we'll see how many people run for president in 2020. But there's a lot you can do for your community other than running for office. Many other ways to get involved politically without running yourself. So how would you say, or what would you say, are some of the reasons you don't do as much as you sometimes think you would like? Give us a call, 212-433-9692. WNYC, 212-433-9692. And here with us now to talk about what some of the obstacles that he's encountered are and how people can get involved in community level work is Mark Winston Griffith, journalist and community organizer with broad experience in civic engagement. He's currently executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, which works to empower local residents in the central Brooklyn neighborhoods of Bedford Stuyvesant and Crown Heights. Primarily, the center currently has campaigns going on to fight street harassment, strengthen police accountability, increase access to healthy food, and more. Hey, Mark, welcome back to WNYC.
It is so good to be here. I haven't seen you in a while.
That's right. It's great to have you back. It has been a while. And since our survey asked people who would like to be more politically engaged what kinds of hurdles they face, I wonder if you have any personal stories along these lines to start out. Obviously, you're dedicating your life to this, the bulk of your work. What was it like getting into it?
Well, for me, I mean, it's a little difficult for people to relate to my story, perhaps, because I've been pretty much engaged since I left college. I mean, I was a student activist, and while everyone else was, going to law school, medical school, becoming an engineer, all I knew is that I wanted to organize, and I just didn't know how to do it. And so I came home to Central Brooklyn and asked around, and my cousin actually happened to volunteer for an elected official. And I went to the elected official's office, volunteered for him, and then that just led to one thing or another. And within a few months, I was working as the chief of staff for the local assemblyman. So that just kind of started me on a path, both kind of in the system, but also outside the system.
So this was kind of always your thing. So it's no wonder that you've wound up in the position that you're in, running something like the Brooklyn Movement Center. How do you reach out to people who you don't expect to have the kind of full-time involvement that you have to do something, anything, as part of a cause?
Yeah, I mean, I think it happens in different ways. One, we go to people, and then sometimes people come to us. And the way you go to people is either through events or door-to-door, and it's just really about identifying what is important to them, whether it's their children, whether it's public safety, whether it's healthy food. Everyone has a set of issues that are of importance to them. And so you just try to connect those issues to either a cause, an organization, something that will help them exert some kind of influence over that issue. And that's what I think brings the most satisfaction to people.
And what do you find is the biggest hurdle or excuse, if that's the right word, for people who actually do want to do something but then don't actually take a next step?
Many people just don't know where to start. They just don't know who to ask, particularly if you're new to a neighborhood. You have this, may have the sense that, okay, I'm disconnected from everyone. I want to be reconnected, but I just don't even know where to begin. I don't know how to make sense of my interests and my desires and how to sort of funnel that into something that is constructive. So, what I tell people is oftentimes just start with where you are, whether if you're in a building, start with your tenants association. If you're in a block or you own a home, be part of the block association. If you're part of a faith institution, be a part of that. We as an organization, it's a little bit one step removed for us, because you actually have to, either we have to come to you or you have to kind of go out of your way to find out about us and then come to us. So it's not as natural connection to us as it would be for other people.
Let's take a phone call. Amir in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amir.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. The reason why I personally don't get engaged more, and believe me, I have the fire in my belly. I'm an artist. I'm a visual artist and a graphic artist. And so what happens is that I look at this picture here. I look at what is going on. As badly as I want to change the status quo, I look at my options, right? And so I see that it is almost impossible to actually make a difference. And what happens is that I look at even the institutions that are supposed to be left or progressive institutions, I look at their performance, right? I look at the fact that when people started talking about fake news, and then various news organizations were like basically censoring information and blocking people out, I saw that this very station said nothing in support of the people who wanted to say what the heck they wanted to say. All of a sudden, if you say something that does not toe the line, if you say something that is not the accepted convention, all of a sudden you have fake news, and it is fair, you know, it's fair for them to just, like, block you out. Like, all of media, Western media right now, including this station, will block you if what you say is not what they're pushing. In other words, they call you fake news, they call you conspiracy theorists. And guess what? I'm telling you, the people are discouraged because they see there will be no change because the media are manipulating the information intentionally so that we don't have a voice.
I'm going to leave it there and get a reaction from Mark and move on. And I would mostly plead, you know, not guilty on our part for not giving people a voice. Maybe that your call, Amir, is maybe one example of that. But Mark, the key thing to me that I heard from Amir is he used the words, it's almost impossible to make a difference. Sure. And whether that's because the media won't give enough voice to maybe people who agree with him on whatever the issue is, or for a million other possible reasons, a lot of people feel like, you know, they'd be a pebble in the ocean and it's almost impossible to make a difference.
Sure. I get that. And we see that a lot, actually. And particularly when it comes to electoral politics, you know, people stay on the sidelines. They don't vote because they feel like they can't make a difference. And they're just sort of overwhelmed and intimidated by the culture wars that are, and the noise that's going on around them. And what I would say to that is, you know, that's what you see in the headlines. But there's so many ways for you to make a difference on a micro level, in ways that I think in many ways are more meaningful to you than just what you see on TV. I mean, if you joined our organization, for instance, you would have been involved in, you know, starting a food co-op for a healthy, you know, for feeding people with healthy and sustainable food. You'd been part of some very meaningful police accountability work, some very meaningful environmental justice work. There are so many different ways in which you can have an impact on not only yourself, but on what's happening to people around you, and just not get caught up in what you see in the popular media, and understand that there's a whole other world that's operating below that.
How much time do you think people have to commit in order to do something to make a difference?
That's what's so lovely about civic engagement, is that it really can be an hour a week or a month, or it can be, you know, 20 hours a month. I mean, we have people in our organization, and we don't even have what you call volunteers. People join our organization, so they're stakeholders. But people find their niche. They find what it is that either they're interested in or what they're good at, and they're able to make a contribution in pretty easily, because we have a vast reservoir of needs that people can actually satisfy.
And listeners, if you're just joining us, WNYC and Gothamist are surveying listeners to find out what kinds of civic engagement you participate in. But even more to the point of the survey, what the hurdles are to doing more and how we can help people get more involved. If you want to take the survey, particularly with respect to hurdles, in addition to whatever it is you are doing, go to wnyc.org/civic survey, wnyc.org/civic survey, and we're taking some phone calls right now, all our lines are full at the moment, on what have been hurdles for you. If you feel like in your head, in your heart, I want to get more civically engaged, politically engaged, but you haven't actually been able to do it or taken that step to do it. And helping us with this is Mark Winston Griffith, the executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, which works to empower local residents in central Brooklyn on a variety of issues. Monica in Fort Greene, you're on WNYC. Hi, Monica.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. I love your program so much.
Thank you.
So I am a civic activist virgin. I just got started. I'm in my 30s, and it's kind of shocking and saddening to me that I just got started, especially considering the issue that I'm facing, which is that I live in a neighborhood that's been gentrified very, very quickly. I've been here for 12 years, and we have a beautiful park, a historic park called Fort Greene Park. And I just found out on WNYC about a month ago that they were taking 58 trees down from the park for a redesign. And so I was like, what? How can that happen? And what I realized was that in the last year, this design plan passed Community Board 2, it passed Landmarks. I didn't know about it. And that's on me that I didn't know about it. It's on me that I wasn't involved. I realized that I don't know anything about civic engagement in my neighborhood. And so then I started to reach out to other people. And the reason it was on the news is because there is a group of people that are fighting for it. But they're like professional activists. Mm-hmm. This is what they're amazing people. This is what they do. But when I started to go out to my neighborhood and asking people who use this park, you know, I'm a dog walker. This is an area of the park that is predominantly used by either public housing residents or nursing home residents or dog walkers. Nobody knew about it. And so it turns out that there's a system in place where if you are somehow vested in this redesign, whether you're the parks department, you're getting a bunch of money from the mayor's fund, or you're a developer and you're developing that area, whatever it is, mm-hmm. you're going to know about the meeting.
So the big obstacle that you're pointing to, and that's very clearly stated, Mark, is information flow. Mm-hmm. So Monica mentioned not knowing what the local community board is doing, for example. How many of you listening right now know anything about what your local community board does? So there's obviously an obstacle of even knowing what the issues are that you might want to get involved in your neighborhood.
Yeah, and I think that actually community board is the perfect place to start. You know, for anyone who's gone to a community board, you know that they could be frustrating, long, really maddening places to be sometimes, because you're seeing where like the sausage is being made in terms of civic engagement. But you will hear, not only will you hear so much, but there are people in that room, whether they're professional activists or not, they're just lay people who care about their neighborhood. You will be plugged in. In a half hour, you will learn more about what's going on in your neighborhood than you probably ever have. And so I think that as a civic engagement virgin, so to speak, a community board is the perfect place to start. And the ignorance at which you were talking about, it's going to disappear very quickly spending some time there.
People can get on email mailing lists, I presume, from community boards. Do they have them generally?
Yes. If you go to a community planning board and you sign some paper, you will, within a few weeks, you may even be, you know, you may rue the day that you did that.
That's right, that you gave them your contact information.
Exactly.
There are a couple of interesting things coming up on Twitter, and listeners, you can tweet your answer to the question about hurdles to more civic engagement at Brian Lehrer. Someone wrote, quote, "I was thinking about participating, but childcare can be an obstacle. Mm. I often bring my kids, 6 years old and 9 years old, to meetings." And then three have mentioned infighting in the organizations that they've tried to get involved in as ultimately dissuading them from deepening their involvement.
Yeah, well, childcare is a huge issue for everyone. We make a point of providing childcare at our organization. And I think that any organization that's, you know, it is truly invested in doing good work and making sure that people can participate will have childcare. In fact, we have people whose role it is within the organization to provide childcare to others. In terms of the infighting, well, that's just something you have to work with. I mean, that's not just activism. That's life, you know, particularly the more tough issue, the tougher the issue you're working on, the more people are going to be divided, the more they're going to have, they're going to be coming at it from different angles. And I understand that sometimes it can be, get to the point of being dysfunctional, but I would encourage you to stick it out. And so much can be learned and so much can be gained by being a part of conflict and coming out at the other end of it.
Jack in Springfield, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Brian. Love your program.
Thank you so much. And I don't always say, you know, there are so many places in New Jersey we take phone calls from, and I don't usually say the name of the state because, you know, we're all over New Jersey. We know if I say you're from Mendham or you're from Newark or wherever. But I say Springfield, New Jersey, because I think there's a Springfield in about 40 different states. So anyway, go ahead.
Not to mention the Simpsons.
That's right.
But
state unnamed.
I was going to say that we have problems. I'm a volunteer fireman in my town, and we have problems recruiting people. And it of course, being a volunteer fireman, you know, is kind of above and beyond in a lot of ways. But it seems like the blocks that people have are that they, you know, they're in their own bubbles, basically, and they always think that somebody else is going to take care of it, and that there's enough people that can do that. But we find that we get the most people, the younger people, the kids that are just starting out of high school, you know, and they're about to go into college. And so I think that's one of the areas that could be, you know, where people should, they have the time to get involved. The other thing is, you know, you're in different phases of your life. You guys already mentioned this. You're raising kids, or, you know, you just don't have time because of work. So it depends on the phase of life you're in, really. And that's really what I wanted to say about it.
Jack, thank you very much. And I think we may get an interesting follow-up on what Jack just said from Allison in Little Compton, Rhode Island. Now, Rhode Island, I have to say, because we don't get a lot of calls from Rhode Island. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thank you kindly for taking my call. I'm a child of the 50s, and in those days, all of our mothers volunteered. It's just what they did, you know, whether it was the bake sale or the voting or whatever. And I think that if you fast forward to the culture of kids under the age of 40 or 45, their mothers worked, and they did not volunteer because they were working. So these younger people don't know. I mean, I was canvassing for the Cancer Society when I was 11. Kids, they just don't have
I hear where you're going with that, Allison. Thank you very much. And Mark, I mean, on one level, there are different class-based stories to tell here, and she's referring to mothers who, in an older era, tended to stay home, and so volunteering was women's work, and a lot of more stay-at-home moms did that. Of course, people from lower-income categories, and women always had to work,
right?
And that's often where the activism is both most needed and most prevalent, mm-hmm. even despite working. But there is a gender issue here.
There is. And I think that getting back to the whole issue of childcare is that you have to be very mindful of the things that keep people out. They're not only out of your organization, but just sort of barriers that people have in work, in life, in general. And again, if you're going to be an open organization, if you're one that's going to facilitate involvement, then you have to work like hell to break down those barriers and make sure that everyone who steps through the door has an equal opportunity to participate. And so whether that's being, you know, whether you're how you're physically abled, whether it's whether you have children, whether it's, you know, whether you work during the nights and can't make those kinds of meetings, you have to do what's necessary to accommodate all the different you know, lifestyles and lifestyle choices that people have made.
All right. So as we come to the end of our time, we want to thank you for helping us out with so much context by giving you an opportunity to shout out any of the Brooklyn Movement Center's current projects that you might want people to get involved with.
Oh, great. Well, thank you. Well, for instance, you know, we're doing a lot of organizing around Saeed Vasso was killed in Crown Heights on April 4th. And so we're doing a lot of organizing around that to make sure that his family gets justice and the police release the names of the officers and video information. Also, the Food Co-op I would shout out, as well as Brooklyn Deep, which is our own citizen journalism project that we're running there. So all those different things are available to you at the Brooklyn Movement Center.
So Mark Winston Griffith, Executive Director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, listeners, WNYC and Gothamist are surveying listeners to find out what kinds of hurdles there are to you doing more and how we can help get people more involved. If you want to take the survey, just go to wnyc.org/civicsurvey, wnyc.org/civicsurvey. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and my next guest has a new book that's an intimate portrait of the lives of transgender men. a group that has been until recently relatively invisible. In fact, it used to be thought that trans people are more often those who go the other way, male to female. Arlene Stein writes about how trans men's transitions has affected them and their communities. She's a professor of sociology at Rutgers and a writer whose new book is called Unbound, Transgender Men and the Remaking of Identity. Hi, Professor Stein. Welcome to WNYC.
Hello.
And Professor Stein is joined by Ben Shepherd, one of the people whose stories she tells in the book. Ben, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor Stein, this book largely focuses, obviously, on transgender men who, you write, were somewhat invisible for a long while, and until relatively recently, even people involved in the community thought there were way fewer transgender men than transgender women. Did that turn out to statistically be wrong?
No, I think it's true that until recently, the numbers of people who are able to transition from femaleness to maleness has been actually much smaller than those who are able to transition the other way.
Able to?
Yes. They didn't have access to the kinds of bodily modifications that transgender women had access to. They didn't have access to the resources that they needed in order to make the, you know, very difficult sometimes decision to transition. And it's only really been in the last few decades that we've seen the rise of transgender men.
And Ben, when you were growing up with the gender you were assigned, which was female, I gather you didn't even really know what being transgender was. So what would you say to anyone listening who has questions or uncertainties about their own assigned gender?
I think that's a great question. I know for me, it took meeting other trans folks and recognizing that I wasn't alone. I think a lot of my growing up, I thought that there was something wrong with me, or there was this, you know, not really being able to articulate what I was feeling and struggling with. And when I was able to kind of put a name to that, it made me realize, oh, I'm, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. I'm not crazy. I'm not any of these things. Like that this is, you know, there are options out there.
And Professor Stein, you're right about how a person's gender is never just an individual thing. It involves lots of people. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that?
Well, we grow up in families. We grow up in communities. We grow up in relation to peers and teachers and authority figures of all sorts. And the world as it is organized into two categories, male and female. And there's a lot of pressure placed on individuals to conform to one or the other.
And so you use the term in the book, gender dissidents. Mm-hmm. Dissident is such a strong and political word, it almost makes it sound like, well, people are deciding that they're not the gender that they were assigned at birth by choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, many people believe that they have a choice to claim a transgender identity. Maybe they feel gender variant, but they don't necessarily see that as a political identity. Some people believe it is a political identity. Other people just think of it as something that is just the way they are. There's a wide variety of different understandings of what transgender means.
Where are you on that scale, Ben?
That's a great question. So I think for me, I definitely, and actually this is a conversation that Arlene and I had about identity and where I landed. And I feel like in terms of, you know, male versus femaleness, you know, in terms of my mind and my spirit, I definitely feel a little closer to obviously the masculine side. So if it was a scale of 1 to 10, I'd give myself a 6 or a 7 on if 10 was masculine. In terms of my body, I definitely feel like a 10, and I feel very grateful and fortunate that that's an opportunity I've had to be able to align my physical self with.
But the term gender dissident, because people who may want to put down the whole thing as, you know, deviant or whatever they want to call it, might say, well, you know, just be who you are, meaning be who you were born as or assigned to at birth. If it's a choice, then it's a political statement. So gender dissidents, how does that term strike you?
I mean, I think, so for me, I think that it's accurate that sometimes to be yourself, you do have to kind of strike against what society deems is normal or healthy, right? I think so
that's the context of dissident.
Right, yes.
And one of the things that Professor Stein writes about you is about how your family took the news that you planned to transition. So Professor Stein was just talking about, you know, how, yeah, on one level we're individuals, but also we grow up in families, we grow up in communities. What were some common themes for you of family reaction?
Yeah, I think, and to be fair, I think it was a journey, like this whole journey, even being part of the book, is definitely one that is unique to my family too. And I think everyone had, and is continues to have, their own journey with it. For some, I know for my parents, it was something that was very challenging, and that was something that I knew was going to be very challenging for them. I intentionally made the decision to move home and go through my transition with them, because to me, and this is just for me personally, felt really important to take them on that journey and have them be part of my transition, because I knew it would also help bring them along with me.
And Professor, you're right about how transgender culture and acceptance moved slowly for decades, obviously it did, and recently, within a generation, there seems to have been a big shift in language and awareness and acceptance, although certainly acceptance is not as widespread as it could be. So what would you say to people who have a hard time understanding and accepting transgender people?
Well, there's a huge variety of different types of individuals of all sorts. We now understand sexuality to be a complex matter, and most of us believe that sort of homosexuality is something that is a way of being in the world that is acceptable. And in a similar way, people are understanding gender as something that exists on a spectrum. And there are many people who have been assigned a specific gender at birth who feel that as they get older, that gender does not reflect who they are. In a similar way, transgender people are creating a movement that reflects, and is an outgrowth of, in some sense, the gay and lesbian movement, and sort of takes it one step further.
Ben, you've worked, I see, as a political organizer and on campaigns. So where do you fall on the optimistic, pessimistic spectrum for trans rights and, for that matter, basic safety in this political environment?
I think in the current political environment, it's definitely it's definitely challenging for sure to get things passed. I think especially, we see – there are multiple campaigns happening currently all across the country just for basic trans protections. And I think in the current political climate, it's also challenging. And I think it's challenging to be safe. And I think it's something that trans people, and especially folks that are gender nonconforming or don't have what one would call passing privilege, meaning that the public views them as they perceive their own identity to be, right? I think for those folks, it's a very dangerous place to be, where people who maybe aren't as knowledgeable or as accepting are feeling emboldened to speak their mind and sometimes act in violence. And
I'm sure you're disappointed with the president for at first running on, anybody can use any bathroom that they identify with at Trump Tower. And now he's become kind of regressive on this in the White House, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, just the rhetoric that was used by Trump, and then also the his talking about banning trans folks from the military, and all of those pieces. I mean, those are all things that while yes, there are potential policy implications for that, but I think more so, I mean, that when you have somebody like a trans person that's sitting at home, maybe that's a kid that's sitting in rural America who doesn't have access or resources or support, when they hear those things, like, that hurts, and that, when we see these high rates of suicide in the trans community, it's because of, I mean, words hurt and words do have impact, and I think too often we lose sight of that.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. For today, my guests have been Arlene Stein, professor of sociology at Rutgers, whose new book is called Unbound, Transgender Men and the Remaking of Identity, and Ben Shepherd, one of the people whose stories she tells in the book. So Professor Stein and Ben Shepherd, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.